Promotion Man, the true backstories of the most iconic bands in the world, told by Fred Myers and interviewed by me, L.A. Lloyd. Get involved and interact on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You'll find the links at promotion-man.com. That's promotion-man.com. Download the weekly Promotion Man podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or your favorite podcast provider.
Excellent. Mr. Paul Fishkin, everybody.
What are you, you calling me to work me on a Poe record or what, man?
Yeah, well.
Man, good to hear your voice. It's been a while.
Yes, it has been a while.
How you been? Doing, man? I'm doing good, man. You know, we're like everybody else here, but still in Austin and still trying to play some rock and roll, man.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about, I wish I was still going to be promoting a Poe record. She disappeared.
That she did. She fell off the face of the planet.
Yeah, she got great advice. Somebody told her to clean house.
Yeah.
So what she did was clean the dirty parts, but stupidly also clean the clean parts.
Right.
So today our guest is Paul Fishkin, and Paul and I go back a long ways because at Warner Brothers, they were really good at joining forces with smaller boutique labels.
Yeah.
And we had all talked about their relationship with Sire Records, Island Records, and we also had the label Bearsville.
Yeah.
And Paul, how did your career get started anyway?
Well, I was from Philadelphia. And I was managing bands in the late 60s, and the Electric Factory. The clubs, there was the Trauma and the Electric Factory. Anyway, I was managing bands. I was a hippie. I was a dropout. I actually still finished college. I was one of the few turn-on, tune-in, dropout guys who actually
got a degree.
Finished college, got a degree out of sheer Jewish guilt. My parents, it never went away where they told me if I didn't become something like a doctor or a lawyer or a pharmacist, I'd be a nothing or an accountant, whatever. Anyway, so I actually graduated pharmacy school and became a pharmacist in the middle of the Philadelphia, alternative life scene there. I was one of the early dropouts, and I was making sandals, living in an anarchist commune.
Nice.
Pharmacy school.
Nice.
And, that's crazy.
And being a complete music nut, of course.
And you had the Philly sound. I mean, the Philly sound is famous. I mean, Holland Dozier Holland, I think, came out of there. Is that right?
No, that's Detroit.
Okay, Gamble was a Gamble. Then it was Gamble and Huff.
Gamble, Huff, and Tommy, Linda Creed, Tommy Bell, Gamble, Huff.
And then Hall and Oates. Didn't Hall and Oates come out of there?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
In Philly, they were Whole Oates.
Whole Oates.
Daryl had bounced around to different groups, and he was a friend of my brother's, but I actually missed the opportunity with him. But anyway, I was managing bands. I got involved because they, needed money, and their manager was a speed freak, and I was just a groupie to the group. And Todd was in this group. It was called Woody's Truck Stop.
Todd Rundgren, and, you're talking about.
I'm sorry. Yes, Todd Rundgren. I forgot him.
No, that's what we're here for. That's what I'm here for.
Yeah.
Todd Rundgren. Yes.
Yes.
So I wound up managing this band because their manager was a speed freak, and he absconded with all the money and left. And so I wound up managing them because I sold my last. I mean, I asked my dad if I could cash out my bar mitzvah money, which was about $3,500, and he let me do it. And I bought them equipment, and I sort of bought myself into managing this group. And they were the group in Philly at that point. They were the equivalent of what the Dead was in San Francisco. And, anyway, so that's how I got in the music business. And then and of course, Todd was, magic from day one. He was like 15 years old and playing guitar like nobody could. And I could see he was going to be a big star. So I sort of, attached myself to to that situation, and it was wonderful. And it was, like I said, during the late 60s, and the Electric Factory opened this club called The Trauma. So, and Larry Maggot, who was a great friend of mine, booked those clubs, and I booked the Electric Factory, and I helped him because he wasn't quite sure which bands to book and all that stuff. So I helped him, and as a trade-off, he allowed my bands to open up to all these great bands, and that's sort of how we worked it, you know.
That's a great trade-off.
So, and you're saying that you knew Todd Rundgren when he was 15. So, yeah. If you've known him that long, I can't remember what his big hit, his first big hit.
Maybe he was 16, actually.
Yeah, but I mean, because he had a string of hits. Hello, It's Me.
Hello, It's Me is the one that really jumps
out.
Yeah,
I mean, he's had a lot of really great hit songs. Yeah. And really good melodic and hooky.
I
Saw the Light.
Yes.
Good songs.
That's right.
Yeah, great songs.
They were great songs, and he was a magical guy. He was a brilliant writer, and you know, anyway, at that point, he moved to New York. He left the band, moved to New York, and started a group called The Naz. And The Naz were this, I don't know, he was managed by this guy, John Kurland, who was the Who's PR guy. And they did a big hype on the band, and he treated them like they were a teen band, and he got into all the wrong magazines. He did the right thing for the wrong time. He did, like, this teen hype on this band, and the first album cover looked like the Beatles, and it was ridiculous. But Todd's talent came through, and the albums were great, and you know, they're real collector's items for people these days. And it included a song he wrote about me called Hang On, Paul.
Nice. That's cool. Yeah.
So basically what you're saying is Todd Rundgren was no David Cassidy of the time, right?
That is correct.
Okay, good.
didn't want to be. His actual, he was a British blues guitar band fanatic.
Right.
You know? And so that was his real bottom line. He wanted to be, you know, Clapton. He wanted to be
Paul Butterfield.
Butterfield was actually from Chicago, and he was a harp player. But he wanted to emulate the whole British sound, the Yardbirds.
Got it.
All those guys. That's what where his heart was, and he tried to do that with the Naz. In fact, their first single was called. It was like a copy of a Who song. You know.
So I don't want to jump too far ahead because obviously we got a lot of stuff leading up to other things that you've been a part of. But are you and Todd still in contact after all these years?
Absolutely.
Beautiful. I love hearing that.
Which is really nice. Yeah. Well, my act, except for Poe, actually, I stayed in contact with everybody.
That's great.
Stevie, of course, and you know, these are great people, and they value their history, and they value the relationships they've had over the years, and they, you know, it means something to them. And so that's what's important to me. Anyway, Todd met Albert Grossman, who at the time was the biggest manager in the business. He managed Dylan, Janis Joplin, Peter Paul and Mary.
Wow.
Everybody who was anybody. And he started managing Todd, and Todd wanted to become a producer at that point because the Naz failed. And so Albert started this label called Bearsville Records and asked Todd to do some engineering and producing for the label in the beginning. And initially, it was distributed by Ampex.
Wow.
That's when tapes were still, you know, farmed out to Ampex from the big labels. They weren't manufacturing their own tapes yet, so Ampex was making a lot of money, and they were making all these production deals. So they made a deal with Bearsville, and Albert asked Todd to go find bands that he could produce to be on the label. So Todd came back to Philadelphia. I was managing two bands at the time, this Woody Strux stuff, which Todd had originally been in this group called The American Dream. And so Todd came to me and said he wanted to produce The American Dream. He was involved with Albert Grossman. And so he said the magic words, and I moved to New York 5 minutes later. And because that was a big deal. You know, Albert Grossman was God. And that was a big deal. So I moved to New York. Todd and I roomed together. And he started producing this record. And that was my kind of big break. And then he walks in with a song called We Gotta Get You a Woman. That was
Oh, I love that song. That's a great
song.
Forgot
about that one.
Yeah. So that was his first hit?
Well, that was his first. Yeah, he had a regional hit with Hello, It's Me by the Nazz. It was the original version by the Nazz, which was a very slow ballad.
Right.
And that was a hit in New Orleans and Philly to some degree. It was a minor hit, but the program directors who knew that song and knew Todd, you know, that was sort of the core, the base from which I could work with Todd. So he walks into it one day with this song called We Gotta Get You a Woman. At this point, he wants to call himself Runt. The song was written about me. So that was my great hook into the.
So we want to get you a woman.
So did you get one?
Yeah, it was written about you. That's awesome. Yes. That's a great story.
I'm Leroy boy.
You're Leroy boy. Wow, that's fantastic.
It's well documented. Anybody wants to check, do their fact checking, no problem. So he walks in and says. Meanwhile, I had hit it off really well with Albert. And like I said, he was the biggest guy in the business, and he really liked me because I was long hair and hippie, and I didn't care about anything, and I was fearless, and everybody was kissing his butt, and I just told him where I thought he was wrong, and nobody could believe I could talk to him that way. But he loved it. So I was just a punk and telling him how I felt about everything, and I knew the music, so he really... He really took to me. So anyway, Todd walks in with this. He starts this deal with Ampex. The label failed. Nothing was happening, and so he walks in one day with this song. And I would go to Albert and I said, "Let me take Todd on the road. We go to stations with him. Hello, It's Me. It was a hit that they know Todd. I'll go to Philly because we're both from there, and let me see if I can promote this song because the company that's distributing you and Ampex don't know what they're doing, but I got a good feel about what to do And so let me give it a shot. He said, fine. And the other part of this was that in that same office that Ampex, the production deals were being, were in, this 555 Madison, was Doug Morris, who had a label called Big Tree.
Yeah.
Doug Morris, who later became one of the biggest, you know, industry moguls in the history of the record business. And at the time, he had this company called Big Tree, and he was all over the charts with Big Tree with bubblegum songs. And we were starting to sell albums, and he didn't understand our business. He was not a hippie. And he taught me the singles business, and I taught him a little about all these bands that were coming up and starting to sell records without having hit singles because he couldn't understand it. So we became very great friends at that point and helped each other in the business, and he taught me how to promote singles. He said, you just get this list of Gavin reported out and call every one of them. Call every one of them. Call the program director. Call the music director. Call the night guy. Just call around the clock.
Well, I got to tell you, just interject there. I mean, just to have that relationship where, I mean, you guys were definitely, you know, learning things from each other. And as you said, man, you finally figured out how to work a radio, a hit, or a single. And you were making him understand the importance of album sales as well.
It was like a piece of a puzzle.
Yeah.
You know, where you both had qualities in different areas.
Yeah, we complemented each other beautifully.
Yeah.
So I knew nothing about the music business in terms of how singles were. I had no idea, you know. And so he just said, look, forget what everybody tells you. Here's what you do. He had this New York accent, and I love to emulate him when I talk about him. He said, listen, you call every little market. You find somebody who likes the record, and you send them the idea. If they like the record, ask them to put it on at night. And then you go into the market, and you take 5 singles each store. He said, if it's a small market, it didn't matter how big the market was. This is what I loved about what he told me, you know, because everybody was into the big numbers, and all he cared about was he said, if they have 2 stores in the town, you just go into the stores, give them 5 each, and then you start calling them if you get on the radio. And that's what I did. I called these Gavin reporters, and there was a couple of stations in Corvallis, Oregon, and Salem, and Tumwa, Idaho, whatever they were. They were the tiniest little towns. But a few of them really loved the song. And they already knew who Todd was because they said, oh, I played the Nas, that ballad. It was a big hit, but, the, you know, whatever. Anyway, but Atlantic didn't promote it right, whatever, because Atlantic was distributing the Nas at the time. But there was enough people who knew who he was, and he was starting to get a little reputation as a talented engineer and producer. And a few of them started playing the record. I got the records into the stores. And then Doug said, listen, here's what you do. You call the store up. The first thing you do is ask them what the number one record in town and how many records did it sell last week. And if they say, well, it was such and such a song, and they sold 7 records, and a hit in that store would sell 7 45s. And he said, then ask him how the run record's doing, and how many it sold. And he said, if they say it sold nothing, well, you got a problem. But if it sold 6 pieces, that doesn't sound like a lot, or 5, and the hit number one record sold 7, he says, you got a hit.
Yeah.
I said, you mean I'll have a hit in Corvallis, Oregon, if it sold 6 pieces? And no, he said, absolutely.
Wow.
He said, it doesn't matter how big the market is, that's how you know. If the record's selling out of the stores, it's a hit. It doesn't matter if nobody knows about it, if it wasn't even manufactured, you know, whatever. I mean, that was the great lesson.
Wow.
So I was relentless about it, and 8 months later, the song went top 20. And that was a big hit. And, of course, I went on the road with Todd to some markets, and we talked about the song, that it was written about me. We were roommates. So I had a story. And I, you know, learned about one of the great things about promoting a song is it's great if the song is the hit, but it's even better if you have a story along with it,
yeah.
Whatever that story might be.
That's right.
To get people's interest, it's like, what do you do to break yourself apart from the 100 records that this guy's considering? And you know, Lloyd, I know you know, considering to play, I got 3 slots and 100 records to play. How do I make my choice? I can pick the ones I like the best, or I can pick the ones that are doing great nationally. But in those days, there were enough program directors and music guys who loved the music and were in independent stations who also wanted to break records. And
right.
So you found out who they were. Who are the guys who really loved the music? And, you know, who would be willing to go out on a limb for something.
And a lot of those DJs moved on to be record promoters down the road because the record labels knew they had that passion for music. They pulled them out of radio and got them on the record
side.
And that was the two-pronged criteria to building a record. Could it request on the radio station, mm-hmm. and was it selling at the record stores? And those are the two barometers that really gauged whether they would continue to play a record and maybe increase its rotation or not.
Right.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so, you know, and so that's how it worked. I mean, it seems very logical and very simple, but the truth is in those days, especially with the big companies, they didn't look at it that way. It was much more complicated and much more political, and you could sneak under all of that stuff if you really knew what you were doing and talk directly to the stations and not worry about whether you had a big distributor or not yet, you know, because in the beginning it didn't matter. As long as you had somebody who could get the records into the stores. And even before that, you know, you send them free records.
So let's fast track. How did you get involved with Foghat?
Well, Foghat was signed by Bearsville. Albert played me this music one day, this demo of this band, and they sounded great. And he didn't even, and I said, these guys are great, sign them. So he was actually asking me who to sign. Like I said, I didn't know anything except I knew the music, but I wasn't an A&R guy. I wasn't officially anything. I was just the manager of the band that Todd was producing for the label. But he trusted me. So anyway, so I said, sign him. And then I found out that they were 3 of the original members of Savoy Brown. He didn't even tell me that. You know, he was smart enough to just play it for me because at the time Savoy Brown had built up their reputation as a great touring band in England and in the U.S. And they were considered a well-respected band at the time. They weren't huge, but they were well-known, and they were on tour all the time and opened up for big acts and headlined small clubs. And so they meant something, and especially if you were into the music and you understood who Kim Simmons was And those guys, you know, that meant something. At any rate, that's who they were. And they were great. I thought they were great.
And I don't think Slow Ride has ever left the radio since the first time it ever hit it, man, because it's still just a classic staple on every radio station across the world today.
And then Fool for the City, was a big hit.
Just Want to Make Love to You.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, I Just Want to Make Love to You was the first song. That was on the first album. And that's the one that really blew me away. That version was incredible. And Dave Edmunds had produced the album. Dave Edmunds
also
at that point. Wow. Yeah, he was like a real underground fave, and, you know, he had that hit, I Hear You Knocking.
Oh, yeah.
He had a big hit with that. And and he was kind of a real muso-respected guy by the guys who really were in the end of the music. And so him producing that album was a big deal at that time. And because, you know, once again, now we had the rock stations, you know, the beginning of the quote-unquote underground rock and roll stations, who were very much into, you know, a lot of the program directors of those stations were very much into, you know, the inside stuff about bands and certain guys, you know, were involved with bands. They played the music just because they respected that guy. I mean, it was a great, a fantastic world.
Yeah, I love the production on that song too. The way he did the reverb on his voice like that, and it was a little scratchy, you know. So it definitely sounded unique. He was a hell of a singer.
So you had Todd Rundgren and Foghat both on Bearsville, both selling records.
Yeah,
yeah,
yes, yeah. Foghat actually was selling more than Todd in the beginning. Foghat was the classic, you know. Working band, worked every night, and they came over and toured and worked every small market. So learning about the small market situation and the value of it, when Foghat came over, I told their manager, Tony Otita, and their agent, you know, we'll support any market they go into. You can go anywhere. Wow. We'll support it. And 'cause I learned the value of small markets to build a story. And so they started just touring anywhere and everywhere and built up this reputation as a great live band, because they were. But the fun part of the first Foghat story was I Just Want to Make Love to You, because we came out with that as a single. But at the time, that kind of song wasn't exactly going to be getting populated heavily on top 40 stations. But there were certain stations in the marketplace that were playing rock at night, top 40s that were playing rock at night.
Yeah.
Because they wanted to look cool, because the rock stations in their market were starting to get ratings and playing the best music. And some of the program directors or music guys or the night guys in some of the top 40 stations were really into that music. Mm-hmm. And that's where they wanted to be, but they were on a top 40 station. One of them was Jack Armstrong in Buffalo at WKBW. And so, and once again, you learn all the tricks as to how to get a record played. It's not always just, you know, how great it's doing somewhere else. It's, you got to find situations where it might be appropriate and tell the story and convince somebody. And it's exactly what we did. So he would play it, and he had the permission to play a few rock and roll songs at night. He was the, you know, 6 to 10 guy. And so he started playing I Just Want to Make Love to You. It's a top 40 station, KBW, very well respected in the market. And started playing it at night. And it got huge phone requests, and we got albums into the market, you know, and the album started selling. And once again, we got rock airplay on Foghat, but we also got some top 40 at night play. So we went to other stations and talked some of the program directors into giving their night guy a chance to play some rock music. Because, you know, you better do that, because the rock stations in your market are starting to get ratings. You know, we had all these, you know, once again, you got to know the market, know the story, you know the situation, so you can be creative in terms of how you promote a record.
So, Paul, you know, let me ask you, when did Bearsville do a distribution deal with Warner Brothers?
Well, after We Gotta Get You Woman was a hit, Todd came out with a second album called The Ballad of Todd Rundgren, which was an amazing record. And at that point, I was working as a regional guy for Ampex. Albert got me the job, and basically I was his company spy, you know. And so Todd had the one hit, but their distribution was pathetic at the time. They just used indie distributors, and they didn't know what they were doing. And so we didn't maximize the situation because it wasn't Warner Brothers, you know. But we got enough going to get the hit going, which, of course, made me a hero to him. And so, but Ampex didn't know what they were doing. So he said, look, I'm going to talk Cuomo Austin and see if we can make a deal there at Warner Brothers. I said, are you kidding, man? That's the place to be. Let's do it. And he knew Mo. He had Gordon Lightfoot at Warner. He had other acts at Warner. So, and he was Albert. He was important. So he made the deal, the distribution deal with Warner Brothers. And at the time, the three deals prior to the ones you guys mentioned, the first three deals that were important in terms of what they called then custom labels was Bearsville, Capricorn, and Chrysalis. Chrysalis was
Jethro Tull,
Terry Ellis, and Chris Wright, and
Kiss,
and Jethro Tull, and Robin Trower, and Capricorn was Phil Walden. Of course, they had the Almonds. And so Mo decided that this was a smart thing to do, to make label deals, because he already had a great reputation for signing acts, and Warner Brothers was the place to be, and it was the hip place to be. And but he hedged his bet by making deals with three of the biggest managers in the business at the time, Albert and Terry Ellis and Phil Walden, and made these what he called custom label deals.
Nice.
Yeah.
And so we had the right place at the right time, and the deals were amazing. They were joint ventures, but Warner's put up all the money. And we got to own the Masters after the deal was over. So it was an amazingly great deal and amazingly the correct place to be, because Warner Brothers had so much talent in terms of marketing and promotion, the local guys. They had the best collection of local promotion guys at that time in the business. And as Fred, you were saying, it's guys who were really into music, really loved the music. They just weren't salesmen, and they just weren't guys who... You know, in those days, you didn't go to school to be in the record business. You just loved the music, and you were part of the generation of all those musicians that were becoming big, and so we were like their peers.
Hey, Paul, don't talk too much about those local promotion guys. Fred's head's already gone about three sizes bigger when you said that.
Well, no, you know what's funny? It's funny about all of that is that WEA distribution was a powerhouse all on its own.
Yeah.
Because when you can get product in the smallest corners, you know, of the country, and then you have passionate people who have leaders that are passionate, you know, there's magic that can be made. And then, of course, the bands are cultivated as talent, you know, and they're viewed as talent and treated as talent. So there's magic that can come from that sort of mindset. And that's what we did.
Yeah.
So
and Warner's was the quintessential example of what you just described.
Right.
Yeah.
They were the absolute, you know.
And I was talking to you on the phone last night because I just finished a book called Sonic Boom that just came out this week. And it is a story about Warner Brother Records. And it was really a great book. All right. So you got Todd Rundgren. You have Fog Hat. Do you remember I was transferred from Detroit to Houston, and Murray Nagle was my regional. And we had the biggest softball game I ever put together with Fog Hat, because you guys were playing the Houston Astrodome, and it was a collection of bands, if I'm not mistaken. It was like a Texas Jam or something Louis Messina put on. And do you remember that softball game? Were you there? Because I can't remember too much.
I don't remember being there. I remember the one in Pittsburgh, which was a big deal that we did with...
Well, what we did is we took the band... And then all the record store employees, it didn't matter if they were cashiers or
That's
in the
right.
warehouse, they were all invited. And I remember taking a photograph that had to have had somewhere between 50 and 75 people in this photograph, because it was just this huge group. And we had a ball. We had so much fun. And then, of course... you know, we had the show in the Houston Astrodome,
right?
Which was one of the seven wonders of the world at one time.
I was there, actually. But, I mean, the one I remember more vividly was the one in Pittsburgh. But the point you're making is one of the things about Foghat was, you know, that based on what I was taught initially by Doug and just in terms of, you know, valuing everybody, you know, from the smallest sales clerk to the value everybody had, and that, you know, go to any market, be the Goodwill band, do your thing, work hard, and every market we did a promotion where, you know, like I said, we brought in the retail guys and the guys from the branch, the regional sales, whatever it was. We really paid a lot of attention to that, and because they were, I understood and I was taught from day one how valuable everybody was. It wasn't just the big guys, and it wasn't just the national promotion guys or the national sales guy. It was all the other guys.
Yeah.
And so, and by the way, when we went to Warner's, it was in 71, they had just started WIA. And when we got there, they were still using independent distributors in all the markets except, I think, Atlanta was the first. And so as Joel Friedman was putting together the WIA system as we got there.
Wow.
From the first year, it wasn't together yet.
Wow.
They only had certain branches operating. They were still using independent distributors, which I knew from the Ampex days, because that's all they used was the independent distributors.
Right, right.
And got to know them and got to know that game, too. And so, and then they transitioned to all WIA distribution, and it took about a year, year and a half. And then, like you said, it was off and running, and they had tremendous leverage, of course.
Tremendous.
And so it was a huge difference in terms of their ability to get records out, to get them into smaller markets. But even when they didn't want to do that directly, we did it. I mean, even when they sometimes rebelled against shipping a record to a smaller market till it was, they were still guilty to some degree of waiting to see if a record was going to be a bigger hit before they shipped it everywhere.
Right.
And so we were in a constant battle with them. And it wasn't always a battle. It was always friendly most of the time.
Yeah.
Occasionally didn't get friendly, about making sure the records we were promoting at least could get into the markets quickly, even way before they were on the charts. And that required, a mutual respect, and that required a leap of faith on their parts. If you said, I know this situation, I know this record's a hit, so trust me on this. It's not showing up yet on the charts, and it's not showing up yet on your numbers, but if you'll get it into these X markets, it'll prove me right, and you guys won't be upset. You guys will be rewarded. And so I was able to convince them on a number of situations like that to do that, and it worked out, because I'd never asked them to do it if I didn't know already, either by my ear or by smaller markets testing it, that it was a hit already. So my credibility and my reputation grew from that, fortunately.
Well, and that's great lead in to you signing a young lady that was part of a superstar act.
Yeah.
Can we move right to that story?
Well, I'd like to do I'd like to tell the Hello It's Me story first.
Okay.
Yeah,
great.
Go ahead, please.
Because it's a segue in terms of the quality of the local guys, and so we had so Todd had the hit, and then we came out with Something Anything, which was a double album, which was crazy.
Awesome
that,
record.
That was the first release on Warner Brothers. And the first single was a hit called I Saw the Light.
Mm-hmm.
And if you'll somewhere find, and I can send it to you to show you, but on the Todd did a little blurb under each song on the liner notes. It was an insert. And I saw the light underneath it. It said, dedicated to Paul Fishkin, the man with the 45 RPM ears, but still no woman.
That's great.
So that was the segue from We Gotta Get You a Woman to I Saw the Light. So he wrote that song about me, and then he dedicated the first hit he had off of Something Anything on Warner Brothers to me. So I just had to tell you that. But the best story of all was Hello, It's Me was on that album. The fourth side of the double album was Todd did all the other first three sides, mostly recorded all of it himself. He was one of the first, of course, to record and play every instrument. And so his reputation by that time had soared as a record producer. He'd produced, We're an American Band and Locomotion for Grand Funk. And
He produced Grand Funk.
Wow.
I forgot about it. And that was a huge hit of theirs, Locomotion.
Yeah.
Yes. And that was Todd's idea, to do that. And anyway, the point is Todd was becoming huge as a producer, as a writer, an engineer producer, as well as a performing art, as an artist after the first few hits. And so he was becoming very important. And then, the second single of Something Anything was not a hit. It was called couldn't I just tell you, a great song. And for whatever reason, it wasn't a hit. So Something Anything sat there with one hit off it. It's selling okay, but not great. And then one day I get a call, and this shows there's more than one ways to skin a cat, and from Ted Cohen, who was at the time the local guy out of Cincinnati for Warner Brothers.
And oh, that's right. Yeah.
And we've become close friends, and he was brilliant, Ted. And I know he was going to be more than a local promotion guy. And that was the other thing. I found all the guys, a lot of the local guys who are technically just supposed to work for Warner Brothers, but a lot of them who were really talented guys. And I became friends with a core of them who we really hit it off and who had great musical taste and all that stuff. And so they worked extra hard for me. I mean, I didn't have to do anything, but they believed in the acts that we had. And
Ted's a recurring guest on our show, just so you know.
Yeah, and I was just kind of curious, when you two got together, how did you ever talk? Because he talks just as much as you do.
I just shut up.
Teddy's funny.
Teddy is a funny dude.
Teddy is a funny guy. He is a reoccurring guest on our show, we just laugh because he's got endless stories.
Yeah.
Well, two great stories from Ted about Foghat. One was Foghat. We did a great promotion in, I think, Bloomington, and he hired a helicopter to drop Foghat leaflets and T-shirts or something over the show. Wow. This was all his idea, and he convinced, Warner Brothers to spend the money for the helicopter, whatever it was. He was so proud of it, and he was a huge Todd fan, and we were very close at that point, so he just went out of his way for us. I didn't have, and love Foghat too. So he did this promotion, but the wind picked up that day. He dropped all this stuff out of the helicopter, and the wind blew it, about a mile away.
Oops!
It was a fiasco.
Oops!
Great Foghat promotion, no fault of his own. Anyway, so he calls me up one day from Cincinnati and says to me, you got to release Hello, It's Me as a single. I said, forget it. Todd won't allow it. Todd, at that point, was already into his psychedelic phase, and he was making an album called The Wizard, a True Star, which was a sort of this genius musical production, and he didn't want any more hits, singles released from Something Anything. He had moved on. But Ted called me up and said, look, the song is hit. I said, I know. You won't let us release it. And this was a live in studio version of Hello, It's Me, the one everybody's familiar with. Way different than the Nas version, which was, like I said, the slow ballad. So anyway, he said, Bill Todd, who was the program director of the top 40 station in that market that had no ratings. SAI was the big top 40 AM station in that market at the time. They had all the ratings. But Bill Todd's wife loved Hello, It's Me, loved Todd, and just tortured him to release Hello, It's Me as a single, or to put Hello, It's Me out. And he called Ted and said, I want to put Hello, It's Me out. Can you get records in the stores? So Ted calls me, and I said, Todd won't let us do it. And then we came up with this idea, which is, let's just release it in Cincinnati, just get it on that station, and I'll call Mo Austin and ask him if he'd press up, a few thousand Hello, It's Me singles, and we can just put them and seed the market and not tell anybody and not announce it was released as a single, but test it that way. And it would be an even better test because the station it was going on didn't have the big ratings. So if it really showed up there and started selling records, you knew how big of a hit it could be. So that's what we did. And initially, and this is what I'm alluding to, Warner's didn't do it. I asked, Mo refused to do it. So he just said he refused. So I paid Bearsville paid to manufacture the singles. And I went to Cincinnati, gave them to Ted, and met the sales manager there. And we all sort of plotted on our own to get these singles in all the stores, which is what we did. And Mark Nathan was part of that, too, who worked for me. And so we got all these singles in these stores, and Todd started playing Hello, It's Me. And the record took off. It became number one at his station. And then there was a hot AC or an AC station in the market that started playing it. And then it forced SAI to start playing it. And so literally broke the record out of Cincinnati. And since the stores had the single, we could report sales. And I could go to Todd and say, listen, this happened. This just happened. Hello, It's Me is the number one in Cincinnati. Warner Bros. Has to release it now. And, I had to apologize to him for releasing a hit,
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
Sorry I made it a hit, man.
Hey, Paul.
Yeah, sorry,
but. Yes. We've got to break and make this a two-parter so we can take quality time to talk about you and Stevie Nicks. Okay. Because we have to free up the studio for an air shift.
Okay.
So do
I'm
you mind?
No. We're loving it, man. It's good stuff.
I can talk for 24 hours straight about this stuff.
Yeah, I love it.
Well, and so that's why we would rather just revisit you on part two.
Yeah.
So let's close this one up with just kind of close it with Todd Rundgren Foghat, so we have a closer.
And then we can tease that we'll have you back.
And then we'll tease that we'll have you back to talk about Stevie Nicks.
Yeah, I love that.
Great. That's fine with me.
Okay, so your career with Foghat and Todd Rundgren took off. And the relationship with the Warner Brothers continued to get better and better.
And we've just scratched the surface with Paul.
Yeah,
I didn't even meet Paul to 1995. I mean I've learned so much just about things that you and I we've talked so many times, but I had no idea about this history you had with Todd.
He was Leroy Boy.
I was Leroy Boy.
Trying to get a woman.
All right, so the next time we have you on, let's talk about you managing Stevie Nicks. How about that?
Modern Records, right. Stevie Nicks, Poe, and, talk about having your own label, man. I mean, that just had to be quite the accomplishment in itself.
Yeah, it was great.
So,
and I actually wasn't, just so you know, I wasn't her manager. I was her record company.
Right.
I basically... her whole first 20 years of her recording career, solo recording career, was under my label, Modern Records.
Yeah. Nice.
And although effectively a small label is sort of like a manager anyway, because we do everything.
Right.
But anyway, she had the manager, but it doesn't matter. It's just technically, I just at least wanted to get that.
Well, we want to get it right. Okay. Well, thank you, and we'll set up a next time to follow up on this. Is that cool with you?
That is perfectly fine.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Guys.
Thanks, Paul. Good catching up with you, man, and I'm looking forward to hearing the Stevie stories too, man.
Yes, absolutely. And I want to talk to you at another time about Poe.
Yeah, please do.
I want to ask you some questions. Anyway, okay, guys. Thanks.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Promotion Man, the true backstories of the most iconic bands in the world, told by Fred Myers and interviewed by me, L.A. Lloyd. Get involved and interact on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You'll find the links at promotion-man.com. That's promotion-man.com. Download the weekly Promotion Man podcast on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Google Play, or your favorite podcast provider. We appreciate you subscribing and spreading the word, and thanks for listening.